Welcome back to Dave's Gone By, and one of the things that I love to do on this program is greet musicians that work in the idiom that I kind of appreciate most, that folk, but also pop and rock, and a little bit of country too. And I thought, well, here's someone who does wonderful work, and although it's quite well known, is perhaps a little underknown and underappreciated. So we wanted to shine a light on Lucy Kaplansky, who is with us in the neighborhood all the way from New York. How are you doing, Lucy?
Great, thanks. Nice to meet you.
Nice to meet you, too. And also nice to be listening to your records, although there's nothing quite immediately new. Are you working on a new disc, or...?
Let's put it this way. I'm working on songs for a new disc. I'm not sure when I'm actually going to make the new disc. And then there's something else that I'm not at liberty to talk about.
Okay.
But I will be. There's a new project I'm working on that's a collaboration. And probably in a month or two, we will be talking about it. But so there's a couple of things that are coming soon.
Sure. I wanted to ask about the whole collaboration thing, because you do more of those than most people. I mean, you're almost as known for that as you are for your own work. So people like Bill Larcy and obviously Sean Colvin and Cliff Eberhardt. Do you think, first of all, there's any particular reason why you're often the go-to girl for backup?
First of all, I love singing harmony. It's one of my favorite things to do. And I guess I'm good at it.
Okay.
The main reason is I tend to try to do sort of unexpected, interesting stuff when I sing harmony, and people seem to like that.
Is that maybe the secret of what makes a good harmonizer or singing partner? You throw in a little something extra along with what's expected?
Well, that's what I like when I hear harmony. I mean, Emmy Lou Harris is an incredible background singer, and she definitely does something you don't expect, like, almost every time. I think that's probably true.
Well, I mean, Emmy Lou Harris had, for the most famous thing that I would know her for, is singing backup with someone who barely gave her a chance to practice, which was on Dylan's Desire album. And I think they barely rehearsed. He just said, all right, the song sounds like this, and then threw her to the mic and recorded it.
Right.
Never gave her a chance to do a second take. It didn't matter. You know, she did great.
She did great.
But I assume you get a little more opportunity to work.
Not always. Surprise. Someone who shall remain nameless had me sing with her at Carnegie Hall. This is many years ago. And not only didn't rehearse, but had me sing on a song I had never heard before.
Oh, come on.
I'm not kidding. So, you never know. And you just have to be really quick. And I am quick.
Okay, now why is that person nameless? Who?
Well, because I don't want to offend anyone.
Well, it's not offend. You're just...
And it wasn't a big deal, but somebody might take it that way.
Oh, okay.
And I was thrilled to do it, believe me.
Well, sure. I mean, was it a last-minute choice to do that song?
I don't know. I have no idea.
Okay. So let's also roll it back a little bit to the beginnings of what you were doing, and you were kind of part of that folk music boom that gave us people like Suzanne Vega and Tracy Chapman and, you know, Bill Morrissey and stuff. I mean, did you feel part of a community when that was going on?
Yeah, there really was a community. We're talking about the late 70s, early 80s. There was this hub, which was this place in the village, Folk City, and it really was a community. I think part of what had happened was there was a huge article in the New York Times in 1977, I believe, about the folk revival in Greenwich Village, and that just kind of brought so many people there, you know, aspiring singer-songwriters, and there was an incredible amount of talent. We all just kind of hung out there. I mean, I actually worked there. I was a bartender and a waitress, and I sang there, obviously. But we all just kind of hung out there night after night. I don't know of any other sort of scene like that I feel like that hasn't been replicated. It lasted until Folk City was sold in the mid-'80s, and it was really extraordinary.
It didn't move to the bottom line on some...
No, not really, because you had to pay to get to the bottom line. But see, the thing was, with Folk City, there was open mic night, there were a couple different nights where you didn't have to pay a thing, and if they knew you, you didn't have to pay. So anyone could kind of come in there and just hang out at the bar, you know, sort of night after night, and not have to pay. So I think that was the big difference.
So that also must have been, on some level, a musical education for you.
Well, for sure. I mean, some of the most talented people I've ever encountered were in that scene. I mean, Suzanne Vega, probably number one. I met her. Actually, we were both students at Barnard College. It's a long story, but someone put us on a bill together up at Barnard, and that's how I met her. That was 1980. And I remember that thinking that night, my God, she's fantastic. And I was right. I mean, she really was. So it really... was an extraordinary amount of talent in one place.
And can you think of anything that you particularly learned from watching someone up on that stage night after night? Were there any techniques, any things for crowd control, any picking techniques for guitar, anything?
That's a tough question because probably a lot of it I took in unconsciously. I would certainly say that listening to Suzanne, you know, back before anyone had heard of her,
right.
I think I really tried to write as well as she did. I mean, I remember one time I played her a song, this is again, I think 1980, or 81, and she had compliments for this one part of the song, and I really took that seriously because I thought she was so good. You know, I think I probably really learned something about how a song should be put together from listening to her.
Cool. So you were part of the scene and making a name for yourself, and then at some point, for some reason, I guess it may have been in the 1980s, you gave it up.
Right. It's a really long story. I'm going to make it really brief, which
okay.
is that I was too conflicted and sort of neurotically conflicted to let myself have this thing that I really wanted, and I had to run away from it. And I ended up becoming a psychologist, ironically. And then after I'd gotten my doctorate, I started seeing a really good therapist and realized pretty quickly, because he was good, that I was giving up the thing I really wanted, and I came back to music.
Did you feel
so
like...
I was a psychologist for a few years. I don't work as a psychologist anymore. It's been a number of years. But I definitely learned something in that whole process.
I mean, did you feel that you did not deserve success for some reason?
No, it's way more complicated in your eyes than that. I mean, no, I think, oh God, it really, it's like it is too complicated, but I think I was afraid I wasn't good enough and I didn't want to ever find out. That's certainly one thing. And for sort of larger reasons, I just couldn't let myself have what I wanted. And that's probably the bigger issue.
So when you gave it up for the first few years, and you were doing, when you were like in a mental, you weren't in a mental institution, you were helping what, prisoners or something like that?
No, I worked in St. Luke's Hospital with drug abusing mentally ill patients. And then I also worked with sort of more kind of standard neurotic patients in a private practice. But yeah, I did have a hospital job with some really, really ill patients.
Actually, that comprises the audience for this program, so you're in pretty good pretty good stead here. But did you, at that point, when you plunged headlong into that other job, did you still miss this, or did it take a couple of years to then realize, hey, you know, I miss singing and songwriting for people?
You know, I knew somewhere inside me that I missed it. I was very unhappy, and I didn't know why. I mean, part of how this all became such a mess for me was that I wouldn't let myself see that I missed it. But I remember, for instance, watching Sean Colvin win her Grammys, and he's just someone I had sung with and been friendly with, and I was supposedly, you know, happy with my life becoming a psychologist, and I was just devastated watching her get all of that, and I didn't know why I was so devastated. So it took, like I said, a good therapist to help me figure that one out.
And so when you went back into music, were you fearful? Were you saying, oh my God, maybe, you know, I've been away from it so long, either I've lost it or lost the ability to get a crowd back, or the music scene has changed again, or was it like, no, this is, you know, I know I can do this, I'm in a mental place that's ready for it, and I've got new songs, and boy, I'm excited about this.
Well, I can tell you I didn't have any songs.
Oh, okay.
I was terrified. I was absolutely terrified. I really thought, I have no idea if I can do this. I have no idea if I'm good enough. You know, I was able to have the fantasy, having quit, oh, that if I had done it, I was good enough. But now it was like, okay, put the pedal to the metal. Let's see if you really have any talent. So I was absolutely terrified, probably didn't sleep very well for a couple years. But it, you know, fairly quickly started to become clear to me that I had some talent and that I could probably pull this off. I didn't know how much I could pull it off, but...
And you found a supportive label, which so many people, you know, they're on a label that pushes them for one or two records, and then they may not, the sales may not be up to label expectations, and then they're
right.
Dumped. But even now, when the whole music industry is in flux, you've got a pretty supportive, cool label.
Yeah, that was just a stroke of luck, really, that Red House. I made this album, actually, while I was in grad school, and Sean Colvin produced it. She wanted to produce an album by somebody. So we made this album, and Red House Records wanted to put it out, and it was just luck, because I could have ended up with some other label and nothing would have ever happened for me. And it, you know, maybe we make our own luck, I don't know, but that was definitely luck, and they stuck by me and supported me and really believed in me, and they gave me a career.
And also, you're on some level keeping certain bits of what you do in the family. I mean, from doing a little research on you, you sing songs both by your dad and by your husband?
Well, my husband and I write these songs together.
Right.
I never wrote any songs with my dad, but yes, I do perform songs. They're very quirky, very funny songs. He was a really talented piano player. But the songs that I do that are my own are all, to one extent or another, co-written with my husband, Rick Whitman.
Does he do more of the lyrics or the music, or is it a real...
He's not a musician, and he is a great writer. So he has his hand in the lyrics. Sometimes, you know, they're his lyrics, and sometimes they're more a collaboration. But that's his thing.
How did you meet him?
He was a fan of mine.
Ha!
I met him at Coke City one night in 1985. Long story not worth telling, but...
Sure.
I knew that he was a fan of mine, and I went and introduced myself to him, and that was it. We've been together since that night.
Oh, my God. So that's 25?
25.
That's a
right. Mazel tov.
Yeah.
Yep.
And do you have youngins?
We have a daughter who's 7.
And does she like your music, or is she listening to Lady Gaga or something, or both?
No, I'm happy to say no Lady Gaga, no Hannah Montana. She does love my music, but lately it's been usurped by the Beatles, who she's now obsessed with, and
well, that's
nothing
fair.
Could be better than that.
Yeah. What are you listening to these days?
Well, mostly the Beatles, because all she'll let us play in the house. We try and put something else on, she says no, and she goes, puts on the Beatles. You know, all kinds of stuff, really. I'm a huge fan of Steve Earle's, and I always go back to his albums, and Wilco, and all kinds of stuff.
And I think you mentioned Richard Thompson in one of your interviews as well.
Oh, yeah, he's a hero of mine.
Well, so did you grow up listening to? Were you a Joni Baez, yeah, Collins person?
Yeah, that was the big one when I was 14.
So, right away, we're talking with Lucy Kaplansky. Do you have another couple of minutes, or do you have to... Where are you off?
A couple of minutes, and then I got to get ready to go get my daughter soon, so...
Oh, no problem. By the way, is your husband still teaching at NYU? And I ask
yes.
That because it's my alma mater. What does he teach?
Film. He's in the film school, professor.
Oh, my God, how long has he been there?
Oh, a long time. Like,
I went
on and off 20 years. More than that.
Oh, because I went to TSLA Film in 81 to 86, or 4, so...
He was there starting around 85.
Oh my gosh, I was in the dramatic writing program at that point, so I just barely missed him. Oh,
uh-huh.
I'll probably cut that from the radio thing, but I wanted to get that in there. So, I'm curious also about one of your more recent albums, which was a cover album. A lot of people end up dipping into that well. They've done a couple of albums of original material, and then they feel like they want to do just cover tunes. What led you to Over the Hills?
Oh, that's not just cover tunes.
I'm sorry. I think those are the most prominent, though. But
oh, well, that's interesting. I think there are 5 originals on that album. Wow, no one's ever characterized that as a cover album to me.
I think I'll cut that from the interview, too. Okay, yeah.
I didn't have more than 5 songs. I had 5 songs that I thought were good enough to be on an album, and I wanted to put on an album, and I thought they were strong songs, so I thought about what else I could put on the album, and these were all, except for the Buddy Miller song, they were all songs I'd been singing for years in one capacity or another, and just loved them all.
Yeah, no, I mean, I really liked your version of Roxy Music's, or Brian Ferry, what's from Avalon, what's the...
More Than This.
That's just a lovely, lovely version of that. And I'm curious, since you are back in the business and doing what you do, that also means you've got to tour. You know, you've got to go around to different states and possibly countries. You have a 7-year-old girl. How does that fit in?
I just go on weekends. You know, when we became parents, I just kind of figured out that that's what I was going to do, and luckily I'd gotten far enough in my career that I could do that. So I go out on weekends and I come home. And my husband takes care of her on weekends, and I take care of her during the week.
That's brilliant.
Somehow it sort of works out.
And about the way that music is now, I mean, I asked you about this CD and that disc, and what disc are you working on, because I'm Luddite. You know, I grew up with record albums. And
right.
I even remember 8-track tapes, God help me. But, I mean, where are you as far as the whole new generation of iTunes and Rhapsody and download this and click that? I mean, is there a point where you're not even going to think in terms of shiny discs?
That's a good question. I mean, I'm still thinking in terms of discs because my audience still buys them. A lot of them at my shows. My demographic still buys CDs. That may change, and it may be that, EPs are going to be the thing of the future, or just downloads. And I think the next 5-10 years are going to really probably change everything. So for now, I'm still thinking in terms of albums, but I have no idea if that'll last.
And do you carry an iPod when you go in?
Oh, yeah, that's how I listen to music, yeah.
So what other people do you have on your iPod these days?
Oh, God, well...
Lady Gaga!
I should go look at it because I'm blanking out. Lucinda Williams, Eliza Gilbertson, my old friend, Bill Morrissey, John Gorka, my friend.
It's like you're walking around listening to WFUV without the DJs, pretty much.
Yeah, well, that's a great station, and yeah, I have very similar tastes, I think, as they do.
So, I want to thank you, by the way, Lucy, but I've got one more question that my parents would be mad at me if I didn't ask it.
Sure.
How Jewish are you?
Not observant.
Okay.
At really almost at all. Just kind of sort of evolved that way. And we celebrate Hanukkah, and that's
pretty
about it.
No, but you do Hanukkah, but not Passover.
Well, we do Passover when with my husband's family when we can get there, but they're not in New York, so. Mm. We don't always get to do it. But yes, we would do Passover if we could get there.
Okay. That's now my parents will be happy I asked
them. Good.
And I'm very, very happy to have Lucy Kaplansky in the neighborhood. I want to wish you best of luck with all you're doing. So everybody, please, go catch Lucy Kaplansky. Go get her albums. They're really, really lovely.
Thank you.
And you have been lovely, too. It's been great to talk to you.
Thank you. Nice talking to you, too. Thank you so much.